Hello everyone, my name is Brianna Contreras and I'm Associate Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive. In this episode of Tuning Into the C-Suite, you will be tuning into our first of many episodes that will be part of our new Meet the Board podcast series. Listeners will not only hear from C-Suite executives each week, but will hear from a member of Managed Healthcare Executive's Editorial Advisory Board. A new episode featuring our board members will be aired once a month at the end of each month. Our first guest featured in the series is Otis Brawley, physician and the Bloomberg Distinguished Professor of Oncology and Epidemiology at Johns Hopkins University. He also served as Chief Medical and Scientific Officer and Executive Vice President of the American Cancer Society. Listen in, learn a lot. Hi, my name is Brianna Contreras, and I'm Associate Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive.
Hello, and my name is Peter Werbwein, and I am Senior Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive. And today we have the pleasure and honor of talking to Otis Brawley, who is a Bloomberg Distinguished Professor of Oncology and Epidemiology at Johns Hopkins. And perhaps better known to the wider world as the former Chief Medical and Scientific Officer of American Cancer Society, where he made some waves. So it's really great that you're talking to us. And we're especially excited because Dr. Brawley is going to be on our editorial advisory board at Managed Healthcare Executive. So we plan to be benefiting from his wisdom and insight on a fairly, but not too bothersome basis. So thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'll start off. First off, it's great to be chatting with you, Otis. I first wanted to start off by asking more of a personal, maybe cliche question, just so our listeners know more about, you know, who is on our editorial advisory board. So before I do, as Peter mentioned, you know, some of your titles, you're also known as a global leader in cancer research and health disparities. So to know more about you personally, can you just tell me what initially sparked your interest in the life sciences field? And was it your initial goal to, I guess, hold the number of all these titles that you do carry?
No, you know, I grew up in Detroit. Went to the Catholic grade schools there and was educated by the Jesuits in high school. And they spent a lot of time teaching us how to think, teaching us a philosophy that we should be men for others. I went to an all-boys school. And I was quite talkative, very interested in policy back then. Many people would have thought, and many people thought at that time, that I would go into law or something like that. I was also very interested in science. I had won science fair prizes and that sort of thing. And ultimately, I ended up weaving science and policy together by going into oncology and then doing a lot of things having to do with health disparities and health outcomes. I was very fortunate that I was working for and with the Surgeon General at the time, David Satcher, when he really brought disparities in health to the forefront.
That's great. Thank you. So to talk more about current events, more specifically on race and racism, which is on everyone's mind right now, and partly COVID-19, which made racial disparities in health so apparent and timely. With the recent killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and now the charges that were filed against the police who were involved in Taylor's killings, which many believe fell far short of the charges that should have been, do you have any concerns of the discussions of race and racism is a passing phase and maybe won't lead to anything more? Or do you think more action may, you know, finally come out of these events?
Well, I think civil rights, equity, health equity, just being part of that is a long-term struggle. In terms of what happened to Mr. Floyd, Ms. Taylor, I take a great deal of solace, I guess might be the word, that there's a lot of people who are white, a lot of people who are Hispanic, not Black, who are out there protesting. I sense that the movement has garnered a lot of support from a lot of people that we didn't even see in the civil rights movement in the 60s. I think this is a long-term effort. I don't think it's going to stop, no. I don't think this is just going to peter out over the next couple of months after the election. Everybody will stop being concerned about equity. I do see the movement, by the way, being much more than Black. I see the movement expanding to talk about Native American rights. I see the movement expanding to talk more about women's rights. I see the movement expanding to talk more about poverty, mm-hmm. and socioeconomic disparities, which includes some whites who have socioeconomic disparity. But I'm actually, I look at what's going on in terms of the reaction to those tragedies, in terms of the population, especially the young population, and it gives me very great hope for the future. But it's long-term effort.
Now, to change the subject a little bit, or not really too much, but what do you think that the patchwork of the American response to COVID and the 200,000 deaths, I'm sorry, do you think those can be traced to the country's racism?
Yes, I do think that the response to COVID is partially due to racism. It's partially due to some other schisms too. One of the great problems that we have in the United States is that we have not focused on healthcare, and we have not focused on taking care of our fellow man. When I've been involved in many of the arguments about getting access to healthcare to poor people, getting access to healthcare universally, there's a number of individuals who call themselves American, express Christian values, but they don't give a damn about their fellow man. They don't care about other people. I used to very commonly talk about how when I was in the military, we had this saying, was on Navy ship, we had this plaque as we left the ship every day. It said, "We are Americans, we leave no one behind." You know, I went out in the South Pacific, served on that ship, came back to Atlanta, Georgia, to Grady Hospital, where I was the chief of oncology, and I'd walk around and look and see, we are Americans, we leave a hell of a lot of people behind. You know, the unfortunate thing is, there are a number of politicians who just don't care about their fellow man. I've spent a lot of time doing health outcome studies and showing that people, especially in certain states, don't do nearly as well as other people in terms of healthcare. And when we look at the Affordable Care Act, and I'm not necessarily pro Affordable Care Act, I'm pro some program or series of programs that gets every human being the healthcare that I believe every human being deserves. When I look at the criticism of the Affordable Care Act and the places that haven't expanded Medicaid in the Affordable Care Act, those were the states that weren't doing very well for health care to begin with. Mm-hmm. You know, those are, interestingly, they're frequently also the red states as well. That's an interesting conversation as well. Why is it that the states where people seem not to care as much about each other tend to be overwhelmingly Republican? That's an interesting question.
Okay, thank you.
I'm an academic. I can go there.
Yes, you can. Peter, did you care to react or ask any other questions?
Yeah, so where are you on Medicare for All and the ACA? Mm-hmm. you know, I think the Biden campaign has staked out a position of some sort of public option. But given that coverage is not distributed equally and contributes to disparity and inequity, and I'm curious what you see as the sort of the coverage solution. Are you in favor of Medicare for all?
Well, I'm not necessarily in favor of Medicare for all. I'm not opposed to Medicare for all. What I'm in favor of is all people having access to health care. And going beyond that, you know, giving them insurance is not enough. We need to also have programs to help them utilize that insurance. Now, if someone were to come up with another program that allowed all people to have access to adequate care, I would support that. My problem with those who criticize the Affordable Care Act is they criticize the Affordable Care Act, but they don't propose something that would reach my goal of giving every human being the care that every human being ought to get. If they come up with a better program or an alternative program, I'm very open to that. Now, I'll also tell you, every big social program that has ever been implemented, Social Security, Medicare, has been tweaked and changed virtually every year since it was implemented. For Social Security, it was implemented in the 1930s, and the program has had some kind of change every year since the mid-1930s. Medicare, every year since 1964. The Affordable Care Act was instituted a little over 10 years ago now, and it hasn't had the opportunity to be tweaked and changed and modified because one party keeps saying no. Is the Affordable Care Act perfect? Absolutely not. It's better than almost anything that I've seen so far. By the way, there are a number of studies out there that demonstrate that people are not dying because of the Affordable Care Act. There are a number of studies out there that are demonstrating that people are not suffering because of the Affordable Care Act. By the same token, there are studies out there that indicate that there's more death and more suffering in states that have not expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act versus states that have. All those studies are out there. If people care about their fellow human beings, now I'll go so far as if they espouse to be a Christian, as many do, we need to have programs to help our fellow man.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, you're sort of, religious terms are being bandied about here, but you're sort of agnostic as to the means by which we get to universal coverage and access. But you're in favor of the end.
Yeah.
And of the things that are out there, the ACA is serving that end pretty darn well.
It is serving it well, but it's not perfect. I readily admit that it is not perfect legislation.
Yeah.
Interestingly, by the way, when the Affordable Care Act was implemented, it had already been tested. The Affordable Care Act is almost a plagiarism of what was known as Romney Care, which Mitt Romney implemented in Massachusetts. Interestingly, Romney Care was an invention of the Heritage Foundation, which is a very conservative think tank. And so, it's actually, yes, the Democrats plagiarized the Republicans in the Affordable Care Act. That is absolutely true.
Yeah, I mean, at many levels, the ACA is profoundly conservative. You know, you're using private insurers, and I think the individual mandate, which is no longer, was part of the original Heritage Foundation conception of you know, mandating coverage and increasing the risk pool. I wanted to pivot to a topic that you've written about and thought about a good deal, which is cancer screening. It was sort of a man bites dog story when you were at the at the American Cancer Society and started to raise questions about screening and whether it was leading to over-treatment, over-diagnosis, unnecessary testing, false positives. In other words, that there were negative consequences to screening. As you know, some of the screening guidelines have raked screening back, particularly with respect to prostate cancer. But this summer, the United States Preventive Services Task Force expanded the population of people who that they recommended get lung cancer screening. They lowered the age and the number of pack years. So I guess I'm just wondering how you see cancer screening in America now. There's been some adjustments, but also, you know, with the lung cancer screening, that's a significant expansion. So are we still over-screening, I guess, is the
yes. Yes, we are still over-screening. It's not as bad as it once was, especially in prostate cancer. And by the way, all these themes are very linked, at least in my mind. One of the reasons I was against, by the way, screening can be appropriate in certain diseases and in certain populations. I was sometimes categorized as anti-screening. I'm not. I'm against inappropriate screening, and I'm for applying science to figure out what screening tests are appropriate for what populations. And the Preventive Services Task Force, by the way, has applied science, I think, very, very well. In the 1990s, when I got my reputation and people tried to say I was an anti-screener, we had no studies to show that prostate cancer treatment saved lives. We had no studies to show that prostate cancer screening saved lives. Remember, screening don't work unless the treatment works. We didn't even have studies to show that the treatment works. You know, the first studies to show that treatment of localized prostate cancer saved lives were published in 1998. And screening started in 1990-1991. And we also had the first study to show that prostate cancer screening saves lives published in 2009. We had a lot of people in the 1990s who were pushing prostate cancer screening with the hope that it was beneficial, but the knowledge that it made a lot of money. And indeed, I actually got to see many of the business plans for prostate cancer screening. I actually talked to one marketing guy who was boasting about how much money they made in prostate cancer screening. And I said, well, how many lives do you save? And he says, don't you know this stuff's never been shown to save lives? Openly admitting it. But in any event, you see, when we do things in medicine that don't work, we hurt people. And we hurt people in a number of ways. We hurt not just the people who are getting that test or getting that treatment that doesn't work and shouldn't be used, but we're hurting other people who need the hospital and are crowded out of the hospital and can't get the services that they actually need. Unnecessary care causes health disparities, not necessarily in the person getting the unnecessary care. Not to mention it drives up the cost of insurance and the cost of a number of things. And so, see, in my mind, being very strict to the science, applying screening and treatment with orthodox science, and my concern about disparities, they're all interwoven.
So to just put you on the spot, what do you think of lung cancer screening, which is sort of the newest screening out there?
Lung cancer screening.
Do you think we're at the right place in terms of the recommendations? I think I think it's age
50
and 20 pack years now, you should get screened. Well,
lung cancer screening is a great example of the problem. Every organization that recommends lung cancer screening actually doesn't recommend lung cancer screening. But every organization that has a statement positive toward lung cancer screening says is if the individual qualifies for the screening test and has access to the doctors and medical facilities that can do the screening well, and that person also understands the potential risks and the potential benefits and wants screening, they should get screening. The lung cancer screening study, the National Lung Cancer Screening Study, actually documented that it saved lives, but also screening was associated with instrumentation and diagnostic procedures that cost lives. Some of the people who died on the NLST didn't have cancer. But it saves lives. One of my great concerns is the NLST was done in 30 of the finest hospitals in the United States, and it was done on people who volunteered to go into that study. If I can go back to a Watergate phrase, how's this going to play in Peoria? Okay, I shouldn't say Peoria because they have some good hospitals there, but I worry about people in non-academic settings. I worry about people in rural settings, and I wonder, is screening, is the benefit to harm ratio for lung cancer screening going to be the same in those non-academic settings as it was in that original paper? I do worry that there are some hospitals that are investing a lot of money in lung cancer screening because it can make a lot of money, or potentially can make a lot of money, and they are ignoring other programs that they perhaps ought to be investing in that could save more lives. By the way, when I was at the American Cancer Society, we actually published a paper that said that lung cancer screening, if fully implemented across the United States, and by the way, we have yet to fully implement colon cancer screening or breast cancer screening. They're at 60 to 70% implementation. But lung cancer screening, if fully implemented and if done at the success of the 30 hospitals in the NLST, would save about 8,000 to 10,000 lives per year and cost somewhere around 1,500 lives per year. All right.
The math isn't.
Unfortunately, there are some hospitals that are shutting down navigator programs that would keep women in breast cancer treatment that ultimately would save more lives in order to establish lung cancer screening programs, which are sexy and might bring more prestige to the hospital, maybe even more money to the hospital, but it's not going to save as many lives as the navigator program.
Yeah, hospitals always think like to talk about a big expensive machine and cutting edge, and a friendly informed navigator is a little bit harder to put on a billboard perhaps. So let's try to bring this discussion of race and screening together in a question and discussion. So I guess I have sort of two things that I'm interested in what you think about, which is let's just take prostate cancer. The incidence of prostate cancer is higher in Black men in the US and the Caribbean than any other place in the world. And I believe the American Cancer Society guidelines put a thumb on the scale in terms of Black men being at least having the screening question raised with them in, at a younger age than white men, because they presumably are at higher risk. So I guess I'm curious what you think about screening guidelines that address people of different races and ethnicity differently.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And then part and parcel of that, has screening exacerbated health disparities?
Certain screening tests have exacerbated health disparities very clearly. There were no Black-white disparities in colon cancer or breast cancer deaths in the 1970s. Let me say that again. The death rate for Blacks and the death rate for whites in colorectal cancer, both men and women, and breast cancer women in the 1970s was the same. All right. In the early 1980s, late 70s, early 80s, we developed both screening and treatment improvements for breast and colon cancer. You know what they are. The disparities in death rate for Blacks and whites all started in the early 1980s. And indeed, the breast cancer disparity is greater today than it has ever been. It didn't exist in 1979, and it's greater today than it's ever been, Black versus white. The colorectal cancer disparity in death widened in the early 1990s and is coming closer together now, but there is still a significant disparity. So screening and improvements in treatment do cause disparities, because there's a group of people who get it and a group of people who don't. It causes socioeconomic disparities as well. You know, we don't have graphs of poor white people versus middle-class white people, but if we did, there would be a disparity there too. Now, racial guidelines for screening, I tend to want to avoid them because race is a socioeconomic categorization of a population. It has nothing to do with biology. You know, I have a very good friend who happens to be a very good geneticist. He happens to be darker than me and have a broader nose than me. But if you call up Ancestry DNA or Ancestry.com, they won't tell you, but his Y chromosome is all Caucasian, all of it. We only know this because he actually is a world-class geneticist. I have a very, very good friend who's fond of saying, and this is a Nobel laureate, who's fond of saying, to divide the American population into five racial and ethnic categories is like trying to slice soup. It doesn't work. And, in our racial categories, we lump all Asians together. And it's very easy to see that people from Korea look different from people from India, but we call them all Asian.
Right.
That's true, by the way, in Africa as well. We in the United States perhaps have too much fog on our glasses to realize that people from Ghana can recognize people from Tanzania, who can recognize people from Kenya. And there are some very big differences there. Now, in terms of racial profiling, this is what it is in prostate cancer. It is true that people who call themselves Black have a higher incidence and higher death rate for than people who call themselves white. And it is true that the American Cancer Society, when I was there, the screening guideline actually recommends, again, for informed decision making, where men know the potential risks and potential benefits and make a decision. And it does suggest that men of African heritage should consider screening at an earlier age, perhaps 45 instead of 50. So yeah,
Do you agree with that? I am
comfortable with there are certain populations that we should screen for certain things and certain populations that ought not get the screen. I am always trying to struggle with how we should define it. For example, there's a genetic mutation that occurs in 20% of people who live within 100 miles of the Tiber-Mese border. And this genetic mutation is such, if you take the very common anti-seizure drug Tegretol, they develop a Stevens-Johnson reaction. The inside of their mouth gets raw, their hands and feet, the palms of their hands start peeling, okay? It occurs within 20% of people who live within 100 miles of either side of the Tiber-Mese border. This is not all people from Asia. It's not even all people from Thailand or Burma, okay? Should I profile people from Thailand or Burma to at least ask if they might be of that, from that area, or know if their relatives are from that area before I give them Tegretol? Well, maybe I should just think about another anti-seizure drug first. But, you know, there is an appropriate place for what I will call population profiling. And I use the word profiling purposefully. There is an appropriate place. I'm not sure racial profiling is the right thing. In prostate cancer, maybe.
Well, maybe we can live with.
The Jesuits used to always tell me, always label things what you know, what you don't know, and what you believe, and question what you know more than anything else.
Right. Be honest about what you don't know. So, Brianna, back to you.
If you can share what you think about how the Trump administration is applying science. So, are you concerned that it has done harm to the reputations of the FDA and CDC as government agencies guided by science?
I am very concerned about science, fact, and scientific method. I should disclose to you that some of the people at the FDA and CDC, those are some of my closest friends. I have tremendous respect for them, and I still have trust that they are going to do the right thing. I am more concerned that so many people in the United States don't understand science and don't understand the scientific method than I am what the administration is trying to do. The fact that they can do it is more of a concern to me than the fact that they are doing it. We have failed to teach people in grade school onward how to think. And unfortunately, we have a whole large portion of our population who've been taught what to think, not how to think. And they don't appreciate science. This actually may very well loop back into some of my issues with screening or the acceptance of my messages about screening, the acceptance of we don't know the answer to this, so you as a patient are going to have to make a decision about prostate screening or about lung cancer screening. Some of the problems in acceptance of that may very well have to do with people just not accepting science. It's very interesting. You know, when I was at the National Cancer Institute and later on at the American Cancer Society, I found the American people are overwhelmingly supportive of science. And when you show up at an event and people find out you are a scientist, they make you feel like you are a rock star. But I mean, literally.
It's true, scientists are rock stars.
Yeah, literally. But people don't understand science and they don't want to follow the scientific method.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Tuning Into the C-Suite Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on Spotify, iHeartRadio, and Apple Podcasts, and follow Managed Healthcare Executive on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. For more information on MHE, visit our website at www.managedhealthcareexecutive.com.